Is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Brandi Spergotta for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. Our first article by Hamilton Kane is titled, Author Lawrence Wright Reflects on 9/11 and How It Forever Changed Us. Just before 9 a.m. on 9/11, I grabbed the remote from the top of the TV, settled on the couch in my living room, and clicked on CNN for a weather report. Before the newscaster said a word, I saw the tower's immense gash. I glanced out the window at a plume of smoke, inky and trailing to the southwest over downtown Brooklyn. With the television still on, I moved through the kitchen, stunned, shutting the front door behind me without bothering to lock it, then dashed up the stairs to the roof deck. I'd been standing there for only a moment, fists clenching the rail, when a whine tugged my attention to the left, toward the south. A plane swooped down over the Statue of Liberty in a shallow dive, canted on its side, triggering a thought quick as a reflex. LaGuardia must be rerouting traffic because of the smoke. I could see the plane's snub-nosed profile, the fuselage's gleaming colors. Another thought. No. No, that plane is flying too fast and too low. It's all wrong. I heard the impact, two syncopated thumps like a child's drum. Thump, thump. What had just happened? That same day, the eminent New Yorker journalist Lawrence Wright emailed his editor with a simple request. Put me to work. Fluent in Arabic, Wright had done graduate work in Cairo and knew the complex and often contradictory Mideast well. The players in the palaces, the characters on the street, the zealots in the mosques. His extensive reporting, beginning on that day, grew into the Pulitzer Prize-winning The Looming Tower, Al-Qaeda and the Road to 9/11, originally published in 2006 and now newly reissued with an introduction commemorating the 20th anniversary of that life-changing tragedy. The book chronicles the slow, steady, and the shadows ferment of Al-Qaeda, and the advent of Osama bin Laden as the face of Islamic extremism. The result is a masterpiece of narrative nonfiction, mapping out the tributaries of anti-Western Islamic thought from their headwaters through the quilt that became Al-Qaeda, patched from cells with wide-ranging perspectives on Islam and with a corporatist model funded by bin Laden, the black sheep of a wealthy, politically influential Saudi family. Wright gets it all down, the what, where, when, why, how, and deposits us on the doorstep of the day that changed everything. Along the way, he plaits the various strands into a page-turner. We see the threat sprout among dusty training camps and safe houses, blooming into an intricate scheme that slaughtered almost 3,000 people. In a recent interview from his home in Austin, Texas, Wright reflected on the looming tower, the challenges of militant Islam today, and the ways 9/11 transformed our culture. In The Looming Tower, you beautifully break down all the factions, philosophies, and contradictions within radical Islam. 20 years after 9/11, Americans still think of Islam as a monolith. Why? That's a good question. Islam is as various as Christianity. There are many different incarnations of Christianity, so I don't know why we think of Islam as a single thing. But you're right, it's perceived as a monolith, and that ignores the ongoing civil war inside Islam, which has gone on for decades. The Sunni and Shia split is profound, but even within each side of that schism, there are many different factions. Some are personality cults, some are nationalist insurgencies that are fueled by religious fervor. It's a quilt of organizations with different goals and fundamental beliefs. Islam has a hard time containing the forces within it. We tend to blame the whole religion, but the religion itself is struggling with all these divisions. How would you currently distinguish between Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, and ISIS-K, the Islamist State Khorasan Province, the organization responsible for the Kabul airport massacre in Afghanistan? The difference between Al-Qaeda and the Taliban is that Al-Qaeda is an internationalist organization. The perverse genius of bin Laden was to take a bunch of groups that were targeting their own countries, like al-Jihad in Egypt, Zawahiri's organization, and bring them together under a coalition called al-Qaeda and turn their attentions to the West. In Islamist discourse, there was the near enemy and the far enemy. The near enemy was the one you had to take care of first. In other words, Zawahiri's mission would be to take over Egypt. But bin Laden's argument was that the far enemy was not far, he's near. There are bases all over the area. He focused the attention of formerly nationalist groups to become the internationalist organization we know as al-Qaeda. The Taliban never had international aspirations. It was an Afghan organization. It wanted to take over Afghanistan, and it succeeded. ISIS-K is trying to revive what ISIS was in Iraq. They see an opportunity in Afghanistan by being more radical and ruthless than the Taliban, by taking over that country. I don't think that will happen, but it will guarantee that Afghanistan will be turbulent for a long period of time. The Taliban will ally with al-Qaeda to fight against ISIS-K. In connecting the looming tower to the present, I'm struck by the resilience and fortitude of the Taliban and al-Qaeda. How can Americans adapt to that kind of long-term strategy? It's more about trying to understand who we are rather than who they are. We are constantly fooling ourselves about what kind of country we are. It's gotten us into an awful lot of trouble. We make pledges about nation building and so on in nations that we don't know or understand or really care about. Then when it gets ugly, we pull out, leaving people who trusted us in danger. If we learned more about who we are, we'd be less likely to get involved in those kinds of conflicts. There's an anecdote about an American general who, while talking to the Taliban, referenced his watch. The Taliban commander said, "You have the watches, but we have the time." That encapsulates their level of commitment in the nature of warfare in South Asia, North Africa, and the Middle East versus ours. And another thing, Americans don't really appreciate the level of abuse and trauma being suffered inside these countries we are entering or occupying. We don't understand the terms under which we're going in. Do you feel the CIA and FBI are working better together today than in 2001? In your book, you point to that dysfunction as a central reason 9/11 happened. For sure, although it's not a perfect marriage, because the rivalries were so damaging to our preparation and reaction to 9/11, fusion groups and joint operations have been forced on these agencies. There's now a National Counterterrorism Center with a joint command, not just CIA and FBI, but other intelligence organizations. There are 16 intelligence agencies in our country with representatives at this joint counterterrorism center. That helps. There are desks with people from different agencies in the same room, also committee rooms where they gather and parse dangerous developments, forcing them to share information. The building was actually constructed by Disney Imagineering. I have a contact there who had been a movie executive at Disney, and she says that everything is exactly the same except the cafeteria chairs don't have mouse ears. The looming tower is stunning, not only for its prose style, but also for its old-fashioned gumshoe reporting. Do you think we're losing something in that regard in this age of the internet and social media? Decades ago, writing a long piece was what you did. But now there's long-form journalism, a term that didn't exist. There are a lot of young people who aspire to do that. The internet has been a net positive for writers, not only in terms of access to information, but also for the diffusion of ideas. The internet had caused a lot of havoc, but for the writing game, it's been good, coming at a time when local journalism has been eviscerated by the death of newspapers. Online magazines have proliferated like crazy. There are podcasts. There are opportunities for young reporters to get involved. One benefit of our involvement in world conflicts since 9/11 has been the diversification of the reporting. You see names and bylines in frontline newspapers that would never have been there in the past. They have the capacity to speak foreign languages. They have backgrounds that are different from the press corps in the past. So it's a far more sophisticated internationalist press in response to the challenges that America has faced. In many ways, 9/11 revealed a naivety common to the American people. Do you think we've grown up at all over the past 20 years? It's hard to say. Leaving Afghanistan was a mature act. It had to be done. There was no route to victory. We were only there to forestall what is actually happening. There was some merit to forestalling, but on the other hand, it was a commitment that our hearts weren't in, and that always causes more damage than good. We'll have to see. After the stupendous victory in World War II, we thought we could do anything. But it's been a cascade of failures since because of our hubris, but also because of a misunderstanding of who we are and what our capabilities truly are. When writing The Looming Tower, who were the characters you most enjoyed writing about? There were so many. My strategy as a writer is to find characters who will take you into a world you've never been in before. The growth of radical Islam is such a world for Americans. And then there was the intelligence community, which is a secret society. So you need to find significant figures who can take you on that journey. I call those figures donkeys. They can carry a lot of information on their backs, and they can take the reader into a place he's never been. It's not like a profile. Donkeys don't have to be glamorous, but they have to be native to the world that I'm exploring, and it helps if they are in trouble. All the information that I have to pack in is more meaningful and understandable if it's attached to a person the reader finds intriguing. The donkeys in The Looming Tower, Bin Laden and Zawahiri are key, but also John O'Neill, former FBI counterterrorism expert who perished at the World Trade Center, and Turki bin Faisal, who was the Saudi chief of intelligence and had an interesting span of experience. He was part of the royal family. He also went to school with Bill Clinton in Washington and negotiated with bin Laden in Afghanistan. Do we still have more to learn? The story continues to unfold. I'm so happy there are reporters who are still unspooling the story of 9/11, the events and people who gave rise to it. The thing that still is not understood about 9/11 is why the CIA did not tell the FBI about the presence of two future hijackers in America who arrived in January 2000. Money was flowing from the wife of the Saudi ambassador, Prince Bandar, to people who were in association with these future hijackers. They'd set up an apartment for them. They took them around. They seemed to be supervising them. The information that might break that open has never come out, and I don't think it ever will. If there is one question that demands to be answered 20 years late, is what happened? I'm convinced that if the CIA had been forthright with the FBI, as they were legally obligated to, 9/11 would not have happened. A couple of weeks before 9/11, the CIA asked the FBI to track down these men, but it was too late. The plot had already sprung into motion. Our next article, by Sarah Stillman Berger, is titled, Yes, You Can Set Boundaries with Basically Everyone. Here's how. Parents, in-laws, spouses, bosses, kids, execs. We have a million people to please on a daily basis, and it's no simple task to manage all the demands and take care of our own needs at the same time. But believe it or not, we can do something about it. It's called setting boundaries. Boundaries are essential in every relationship, says Aziz Ghazapura, clinic psychologist and author of Not Nice. Without boundaries, you may end up feeling burned out and resentful, he says. Of course, it can feel super uncomfortable to tell the people you care about to back off, so we enlisted the experts to tell us how to tactfully set healthy personal boundaries without setting fires. First, try not to feel guilty. Most nice people are afraid of upsetting others and being perceived as rude, mean, or selfish, says Ghazapura, who points out that our fear of disapproval is the core reason many of us have difficulty setting boundaries. Nancy Levin, life coach and author of Setting Boundaries Will Set You Free, agrees. We often say yes when we should be saying no because we are concerned that we will hurt someone's feelings. It's our fear that keeps us in the people-pleasing, over-giving mode, explains Levin. But the best way out of fear is through it, according to Ghazapura, who notes that once we take the risk of setting a boundary, we will find that people won't react in anger. Most people actually care about what you want, says Ghazapura. Start by making a request. Levin says setting a boundary consists of two clear parts, a request and, if necessary, a declaration of intention. Start by stating clearly what is acceptable and what is unacceptable to you. This is the request. For example, say to your partner, when your brother makes inappropriate comments, I feel angry and uncomfortable. I don't want to see him socially except at family gatherings. Does this work for you? Then you state the consequence. If the other party is unable to meet your request, the next step is to take care of yourself, says Levin. This is when you let the person know how you're going to handle the situation, she says, stressing that it's important to have a backup plan in place before you make your boundary request. So, in keeping with the example above, if your spouse will not meet your needs despite your concerns, you may respond, "Since you still want to see your brother socially, I will simply make other plans when you two go out." Now, be prepared to follow through. Do not set boundaries you aren't willing to enforce, says Sunny Joy McMillan, certified life coach and author of Unhitched, Unlock Your Courage and Clarity to Unstick Your Bad Marriage. If there is no accountability, then the boundary is basically non-existent. Keep in mind, this is not your way of controlling other people, says McMillan. Instead, it is a way to honor and protect your own physical, emotional, and energetic space. When setting a boundary, be confident. Often we feel like we need to provide an excuse or an explanation when we feel insecure about a choice, says McMillan. And Levin agrees, we apologize because we are uncomfortable. She says that if you have the tendency to say, "I'm sorry," every time you say no to something, it sends a mixed message that weakens and dilutes your position. Levin reminds us, you are not doing harm in refusing to attend to another's demands. Use I statements. While you may need to mention the other person's behavior, bring it back to yourself, explains Levin. This keeps the focus on your feelings. For example, if your in-laws are constantly criticizing your food choices for your children, you can say, "Please don't comment on what or how much my children eat. I will be in charge of that," suggests Julie de Azevedo Hanks, PhD, LCSW, author of The Assertiveness Guide for Women. The clearer we are about how people can treat us, the easier our interactions will be, says Hanks. Be careful not to place blame. If you're upset, it may be hard to keep your anger in check, says Levin. If you say something accusatory, you open the door for an argument that may do more harm than good. McMillan suggests taking time into account when you set your boundaries to avoid a screaming match. Don't set them when you are feeling frustrated, resentful, and angry. Instead, she says to wait until you've had time for some reflection and are feeling composed. Remember, don't worry if there's pushback. New boundaries have the potential to change a family or workplace system, says McMillan. You're likely to ruffle some feathers, but don't let that stop you. Instead, says McMillan, choose to see the pushback as an indication that you are making healthy changes. Realize it may take time for everyone to get on board. Gazapur agrees, "Don't try once and then give up if it doesn't go the way you want," he advises. "The more you practice, the better your results will be." Our next article by Michelle Hart is titled, "Read an exclusive excerpt from Michelle Philgate's anthology, What My Mother and I Don't Talk About." With pieces that range from heartwarming to heart-rendering, What My Mother and I Don't Talk About, an anthology of essays edited by Michelle Philgate, exposes the secrets we keep from the women who gave us life and the secrets they sometimes keep from us. Author Juliana Baggett considers how growing up as the confidant to her lovingly loose-lipped mom turned her into the storyteller she is today. "I'm not sure it was perfect mothering to tell me these stories at such a young age," Baggett writes, "but it might have been the exact kind of mothering that a budding novelist could mull and eventually spin something from." By the time I was 10, I was my mother's confessor. My older siblings were teenagers or already out in the world. I was the only one left, and she was bored and a little lonesome. Or maybe, for the first time, she had the bandwidth to reflect on her own life and childhood. She would keep me home from school to do banking, play casino, and tell me the darkest stories you've ever heard. I remember these conversations happening on our screened-in porch while playing cards. This makes no sense, of course. We lived in Delaware, and most of the school year would have been too cold. But it's always late spring in my recollection. I can see my mother in a house dress, her red hair puffed up around her face. She's snapping cards down on the plastic tablecloth. Our neurotic Dalmatian, Dulcie, is forever dipping in and out of the doggy doors, plastic flaps that my father nailed into place. My mother kept me home if it was a rainy day, worried about the bus on the highway, but also on sunny days because it was too pretty to be cooped up. She kept me home on her birthday, which by her reasoning was far more important to me personally than any president's birthday. Sometimes she had no reason at all. She gave me the impression that school was beneath me. Give the other kids a chance to catch up, she'd tell me, conspiratorially, as if my genius were a secret. This wasn't true, and I knew it. I was an average student, poor at math, never the strongest reader. Because of the absences, I was often lost in history and science. However, I learned something that became very useful. How to fake it. We took the card game seriously, but we chatted a lot, too. My mother had already raised three kids, and so I was more of a compadre. I was used to being spoken to like an adult. I hated it when other grown-ups treated me like a child. I was pretty sure that the rest of the world underestimated children, but my mother's confessions were proof that I, at least, could handle much more. And when I tell you that the stories were dark, I mean it. There was a story of an aunt who had a home abortion with knitting needles. The baby lived for 3 days. In another story, one of my grandmother's aunts hanged herself from a bedpost. And there were the stories that hit closer to home. My mother's father was abusive to my grandmother. My mother told me that when she was little, she assumed that varicose veins were bruises left by violent husbands. I don't recall her being tense or tearful while telling me the stories. I don't recall any big outpouring or rush of words. She was reflective and thoughtful. Sometimes I had the impression that she was saying these things aloud for the first time, as if the memories were dawning on her unfiltered. There were good stories, too. My mother's devotion to the piano, her love for the kind nuns who helped her family time and again, her love affair with my father. This story stands out in my memory. Her father couldn't read or write. From a meager background, he quit school at a young age and started making money as a pool hall hustler. But one evening, while he was watering the grass, he asked her to tell him something she'd learned. "I quoted Shakespeare," my mother said, and she recited this line. "Night's candles are burnt out, and jocund day stands tiptoe on the misty mountaintops." She took a moment and then added, "My father thought it was beautiful." My mother could sense a depth within him, a longing. "I imagine all the things that he could have done if his life had allowed it," she said. My mother's side of the family seemed to believe that stories could save us. They were cautionary tales, medical wisdom, and lessons in love and loss. For a while in my 20s and early 30s, I'd started to doubt the stories I'd heard from my mother. They were too mythic. How does one hang oneself from a bedpost? Another story was nearly biblical. Our ancestors in Angier, North Carolina, set off one night in a storm, a man, a woman, and a baby on horseback. The man and the woman were killed in the storm, but the baby was found wrapped in a grapevine alive. I was a grown woman with children of my own by this point. I'd studied in the Southern Gothic in graduate school. I knew lore when I heard it. One day in my mother's kitchen, my father was doing some genealogy. He was fastidious in his work, only the facts. My mother found it boring, which seemed to me like an admission of guilt that she'd spiced her own family's stories. So I called her on it, in particular the hanging. "It doesn't make sense logically," I said, "and it's just too dramatic." She refused to give in. We fought about it. Eventually, she seemed to give in a little. "Fine," she said. "You don't have to believe me." I went home, living only a mile away at that point, feeling like I'd won. That evening, my mother walked into my house holding a newspaper clipping that had been saved in the family Bible. Written in the deep Southern Gothic tradition that I knew so well, it included the aunt's blind, invalid mother, who in the next room could do nothing to help and had to listen to her daughter choke to death. "What do you think of the story now? Do you still think I made it up?" I conceded. When the baby found in the grapevine was also corroborated years later in a small self-published history of the area of Angier, I gave up. By this point, I was a novelist. And it had dawned on me, of course, that hearing these stories may have, in part, made me a writer or, at the very least, honed my aesthetic. It's no surprise that I'm drawn to magical realists and fabulists, that I love a touch of absurdism. On the one hand, I'm not sure it was perfect mothering to tell me these stories at such a young age, but it might have been the exact kind of mothering that a budding novelist could mull and eventually spin something from. By the time I was in my early 30s, having published my first two novels, I decided it was time to write part of my family's history. Another true story? My grandmother had been raised in a house of prostitution in Raleigh, North Carolina during the Great Depression. Her mother was the madam of the house. This had been kept from my mother throughout her childhood. My mother was the only one who didn't know. In fact, it was my father who told her when, still newlyweds, he heard about it in those slow, drawling conversations that only the men of the family had out on the porch. It shocked my mother, but it also made complete sense, as is so often the case with long-held secrets. To be clear, I too have come to believe that telling family stories, letting them air out, is the healthiest way to live. My father came from a tight-lipped family. His father died when he was 5 years old, an army jeep accident, and he didn't know until decades later, when he was in his 40s, that his mother had left his father about a year and a half earlier. She had scribbled a note in their Brooklyn apartment and hauled her three children back to West Virginia alone. This seemed deeply unhealthy to me, and when I married a WASP, tight lips running throughout his family tree, I evangelized the importance of not having any secrets, telling it all. His own childhood was fractured by divorce, and so he was down for trying a different approach. At this point, my grandmother was in her 80s and not in perfect health. I knew that in order to get firsthand accounts of her childhood, I needed to write the story right away, even though I didn't feel quite ready enough. With a mini tape recorder, I sat down with my grandmother in her pink condo with her poodle in her lap and started interviewing her. She had a wonderful childhood, she told me. She loved her mother and father. She had fond memories of the women in the house. The men would give her nickels to go to the movies. But when her mother went off with a man, she and one of her brothers were sent to the orphanage for brief stints. And by 15, it was clear she could no longer live in a house of prostitution. It was too dangerous. So she married her brother's best friend, my grandfather. When he beat her up the first time, she got on a bus and went home. The part of the story I couldn't bear, and still can't, is that her mother sent her back to him. I learned quickly that my grandmother was fine with doing the interviews, but I wasn't. I found it difficult. I would get emotional and have to go to her pink bathroom, splash water on my face, and collect myself. Eventually, I taught her to use the tape recorder and talk into it deep into the night, the hours when she was often wide awake. This way, I could listen to the tapes and stop them when I couldn't go on any longer. And now there were things that my grandmother told me not to tell my mother. Not many, but they were notable. And so I became a vault between them. While my grandmother's health was failing, there was a moment when she said to my mother, "There's something I haven't told you." It was clear that it was something important, something that she needed to tell my mother before she died. By this point, there was little left unsaid. The stories my mother had told me had been passed down to her, and there were too many to keep track of. My research had unearthed a lot of what had been quietly buried. Others in the family of storytellers had lived long lives and confessed more as they aged. My mother says that she drew in a breath and thought, "Oh my, here we go." She explains her apprehension this way. My mother had told me so much. She was so honest. I was sure she hadn't held back. I couldn't imagine what she'd spared me, and I was afraid of what she would say. In that brief moment, my grandmother looked at her daughter and read her expression, a mix of fear and maybe weariness. After that one moment of surprise, she said, "Well, maybe there are some things you don't need to know." My mother was relieved. She was thankful, in fact, that she and her mother were so close that there was that quick moment of unspoken communication. My mother returns to this moment from time to time. Did she deny her mother something? Did she ask her mother for a final kindness, and was that the true gift, not telling? I admit that sometimes I wonder what it could have been, but I don't regret it, my mother says. My mother was an only child. My grandmother had her when she was just 17. They were mother and daughter, but they also grew up together. They loved each other as deeply as two people can. I think about my father's mother, the one who left that note for her husband and took her children back home to the mountains. Their father died. Why tell them that the marriage was over? Why tell them that he blew his paychecks on drinking and left them with little to scrape by? He was also wonderful in his way. Why not let them have the few memories that would stick? His perfectly timed pratfalls, his dancing, his easy smile. Why muddy any of that? There's beauty and strength in letting them have their father exactly as they wanted and needed him to be. Like my ancestors, I believe that stories can save us. Our stories are our greatest currency. What one person is willing to share with another is a test of intimacy, a gift that's given. Some people might see my mother's confessions as a burden she lifted off of her own shoulders to put onto mine, but I don't. I see them as moments of shared humanity. She was lifting the veil of politeness of the quotidian, and she was real and vulnerable in those moments. She was honest about who she was and those who came before us. No matter how dark the stories were, they were hopeful. The storyteller is a survivor, after all. I live to tell the tale is not an idle saying. My mother was giving voice to the past, to those who couldn't tell their own stories. Storytelling is a fight against forgetting, against loss, and even mortality. Every time a story is told about someone who's dead, it's a resurrection. Every time a story is told about the past, we're doubly alive. Look, as a kid, I knew that what I was experiencing day in and day out wasn't the whole truth. All kids sense this. I was being protected from something. My mother let me glimpse behind that insulation. It was a comfort to have someone acknowledge that the rosy childhood that our culture clings to isn't real. She showed me that life is complex and rich, dark, yes, but also stunningly beautiful. My mother is still telling me stories, new ones that surprise me. These days, there are more about her long marriage to my father. Their love story is a little racy sometimes. My parents are in their early 80s, both still healthy. Now looking back on my childhood, I'm thankful for all the stories she's told me, not only as a writer, but also for the closeness that's come from telling me her stories. And I admit that I tell my older children some of the family stories as well. My oldest daughter, Phoebe Scott, is now 23 and a sculptor who does life-size sculptures of women's bodies, in particular the bodies of elderly women who wear their stories in their bones and on their skin. The family stories seem to fuel her work in ways that are similar and very different from my own. Still, there's something that worries me. If my grandmother had held on to something until her deathbed, my mother might have this power too. Every once in a while it hits me. What if she hasn't told me everything? What if the worst is still out there? What if there is one more thing? If that moment comes and she whispers that she has to tell me something before she dies, I won't say no. I won't have the willpower. I'll have to know. I'll lean down, even though perhaps I shouldn't, and I'll say, "What is it? Tell me." Our next article, as told to Mackenzie Jean Philippe, is "I Quit My Glamorous Corporate Job to Travel the World." For 6 years, Jakia Brown worked in marketing for beauty powerhouses like L'Oreal and Coty, Inc. To her, corporate America was everything, financially rewarding, glamorous, energetic, fast-paced, until it wasn't. Eventually, the lifestyle caught up with her, and at just 27, she already felt burnt out and unmotivated. So in 2016, she quit her stable, nearly six-figure gig to give into her wanderlust and explore the world. 2 years later, the Charlotte, North Carolina native has rebranded herself as a travelpreneur. Her Instagram handle, @travelingfro, has more than 15,000 followers and a feed that screams hashtag goals. Here, Brown tells us how she learned to live her best life on her own terms, no 9-to-5 needed. "I could not get out of bed. I needed to be at work by 9 a.m. at the latest, yet I ended up rolling in around 10:30. In a meeting with some of the bigger bosses about a major campaign, as my coworkers chatted all around me, I was instead scrolling on Instagram. Finally, someone asked, 'Jakia, why aren't you paying attention? Is this not important to you?' In that moment, I realized the answer was no, it wasn't. Not only was I not there mentally, I physically did not want to be there. Instead, I was using my energy to fantasize about my next trip, even though I had just used up all of my 10 vacation days for the year. This was in September 2016. A month later, I quit. I'd been thinking about doing it for a year by then, originally planning to stick it out until December, but that meeting pushed me over the edge. I asked myself, why do I have to wait? I was looking for clarity in my life, needing to find the most extreme solution that would get me out of the corporate world and make me happy. The simple answer for me was traveling. In a way, I felt new to the world, and this was how I could see as much of it as I could. I had never gotten on a plane until I was 20, and I was 23 the first time I ever went out of the country. For months, I'd been saving up my money, intentionally confronting the reality of leaving everything behind. I put reminders of future adventures on my apartment walls, mirror, and my phone, pinned up a world map with the words "Be Brave" printed above it, and motivational quotes from Steve Jobs, Gandhi, and of course, Oprah. The biggest adventure you can ever take is to live the life of your dreams. It was all about creating a life that I wanted to live, and in that moment, I wasn't. I was going through the motions, getting sucked into the corporate ladder and what I thought was the route I was supposed to take. I was brought up by a single mother who worked hard as a teacher, taking care of my younger sister and me, as she taught us that if you push yourself, you can be successful. So I went to college at UNC Greensboro, got straight A's, and graduated top of my class, magna cum laude. I took the straight and narrow path, thinking that was what you had to do. Get the degree, get the grades, get a good job, right? I started out as an intern at L'Oreal the summer before my senior year at university. 3 months before I graduated, they hired me full-time as an assistant marketing manager. Working in the corporate beauty industry on New York City's Fifth Avenue as a 21-year-old was the dream job. My life was nonstop, but I was ready for it. I had to put my feet to the floor and grind, and there was no room to sink. Honestly, I don't remember thinking for the first 2 years at that job. But after 6 years, it got taxing. And as a woman of color, I felt like the odds were stacked against me. The chances that I'd be CEO or whatever I desired started to feel far-fetched. I dissected my life. Is this really what I want to do? Am I really passionate about this? Is it something that I could see myself doing for the rest of my life? I realized I needed to be having these introspective talks with myself, looking up from my day-to-day, the exhaustion and the 10-hour days, and being honest. I think that's where it all started. When I told my boss, you know, it's been great, he knew where I was headed. I just don't think that this is a path that I want to take in my life right now, and I'm resigning. That was it. I'd said the words, I couldn't wipe the smile off my face. I knew that people would try to talk me out of it. I didn't tell anyone I'd quit until I booked my one-way ticket to Europe. Only a couple friends at the time knew. I was the most nervous to tell my mom. I was worried that from the outside looking in, what I was doing seemed nonsensical. But once I told her, she was so supportive. She'd witnessed the burnout happening and knew I wasn't happy. With a shaky, if that's what you want to do, she approved. During the first 3 months at the At Traveling Fro, I toured Europe. From England to Germany to Spain and Greece and then the Netherlands. They were all beautiful, but my favorite country was Portugal. Relaxing and situated on the water. And despite the low cost of living, the quality of everything is amazing. I'm talking about the food and the wine, because is there anything more to life than that? From there, I went to Israel, putting off a visit to Africa, because deep down, I knew that once I got there, I'd stay. But soon I was in Morocco, and from there I went to Senegal, and I fell in love. I'm still there. As an African American that doesn't know her ancestral lineage, there's a connection I feel to this region, because there's a pretty high chance that my descendants are from here. Living in a black country around all black people for the first time in my life, to me, has been transformative. Back home, I was always reminded every day that I was the black girl. I grew up going to predominantly white schools, going to a predominantly white institution for college, and then working in corporate America. But living in a country where it's normal to be me, and no one is looking at you twice for that, is definitely a feeling that I think everyone should experience. As I navigate this new life, however, I've had to make some adjustments. When you leave something that's so stable, like a well-paying corporate job, you take a risk. It's scary, but my motto is faith over fear. I've had to find ways to make new relationships while maintaining the ones back in the States. I've had to redefine my definition of home, noticing it's more of a feeling rather than four walls. I've had to learn patience as I've realized that creating a brand while trying to live off my passions of traveling and marketing takes hard work. But in the end, I've learned that I don't have to be featured on something like Forbes 30 Under 30 in order to know that I'm living my life the right way. I'm okay with my story. It is enough. Our next article by Bree Schwartz is titled, Hi, my name is Bree. And my mom was an opioid addict. I was swiveling on a bar stool in Brooklyn that was held together by decades-old duct tape, trying to tune out the Tuesday night revelers shouting trivia answers in hopes of a free shot. Sipping body temperature tequila, I wedged my crossed fingers into my coat pocket like I did when I was a kid, looking for protection, hoping that if I kept them tangled tight enough, my mom would live through the night. My husband came back inside after calling his physician friend. His buddy said it sounded like the doctors were taking all the right measures, but I can read him well, so it was obvious this pal gave it to him straight. Like the ER doc told me earlier, I knew she's very sick was code for say your prayers. Just as they're taking the right measures meant hold your wife close tonight, or at least let her eat Cheetos in bed. This might be the last time she'll be able to live with herself. Because the thing about having a loved one with addiction is you can't help but feel like you're to blame. If only I'd gotten my mom the right help, found the right rehab, practiced tough love, never practiced tough love, was firmer with that doctor who was so liberal with his RX pad. She wouldn't have been found alone by her social worker, lips black, oxygen cut off from her organs, barely there. That was November 2018. A prescribed opioid addict, my mom's doctor had been doling out increasingly high doses of oxycodone and Percocet for over a decade to numb chronic pain brought on from a series of slipped discs and other occupational hazards of her life as a hairdresser. Seriously, that's a thing, so tip your stylist generously. And sometimes, still high on her cocktail of sleep meds, she'd forget that she already had a double and would order another round, leading to an overdose. Unlike more sympathetic diseases, there's such a stigma surrounding addiction that for years I hid my all-consuming double life from everyone I could. When other family members were diagnosed with leukemia, the reactions included the type of kindness reserved for victims. Nurturing hugs and F you cancer, we'll get through this together. But when you tell someone your mom is an opioid addict, there's no F you oxy, there's only F you her. My truth is met with recoils, lack of understanding, and an assumption that my mom was a selfish person, as vile as the dirty diapers her immobile body was left in daily while she was recovering. But she wasn't vile or selfish. She was depressed and dependent on a substance that can become habit-forming after only 5 days of use. According to the latest CDC stats, more than 70% of the 70,630 drug overdose deaths in 2019 involved an opioid, and that record number has continued to rise. Since the COVID-19 pandemic, which led to overwhelming isolation, the epidemic has become even more deadly, according to the American Medical Association, with over 40 states citing an uptick in fatalities by September 2020. Deaths from drug overdoses remain higher than the peak yearly death totals ever recorded for car accidents, guns, or AIDS, and their acceleration in recent years has pushed down overall life expectancy in the United States, the New York Times reported last July. Yet despite the toll this affliction takes on so many families, there's still a preconceived notion that all victims are lazy junkies who don't want help. Which is why, rather than explain myself or make apologies for my mom, I simply never talked about it. Rather than burdening friends with my reality, nothing kills a Margarita Monday quite like chatter about the vile stains I just cleaned off my mom's carpet, I instead began documenting these moments in my mind through fantasy social media posts. As someone who came of age in the era of the emo AOL away message, somehow thinking in Instagram stories became a coping mechanism for me. Of course, I'd never actually share any for pity likes, but to keep myself entertained while I shuttled back and forth from New York City to her Long Island hospital or her nursing facility in the suburbs, I started exclusively thinking in ironic IG captions like hashtag dead, literally. It's fun, you should try it the next time you're under duress. After my mom's overdose, blood stopped flowing to her intestines, so they fixed the glitch by redirecting her waste to a hole on her stomach instead of through, well, you know. Caption, another hashtag ostomy bag leak. Hashtag poop happens. I giggled to myself after finding her filth-smeared tummy in the neglectful nursing home with a puppy training pad tossed over her open wound. Hashtag everybody is a bikini body. Looked cute. Might delete later. On the weekends, it was time for the hashtag self-care Sunday series. Fake followers were treated to fictitious snaps, portrait mode always, of the battery-operated votives brought in to spruce up the space she shared with a dementia patient prone to night terrors. Caption, a gal can never have too many hashtag candles or hashtag catheters. The holidays were, of course, ripe for make-believe memes. How it started versus how it's going, hashtag naughty list. Hashtag Feast of the Seven Hospital Cafeteria Fishes. And knowing how well 90s nostalgia plays on the millennial platform, when my mother handed the crumpled up napkin that held the part of her tongue that had fallen out, another charming gift from drug-induced oxygen deprivation, All I could think about was how much the piece resembled the mystery flavor Airhead, white and rubbery. I mused that if I was really morose, I'd photograph a flat lay of the iconic candy with my old Steve Madden platforms and Claire's body glitter for some scroll-stopping shimmer. TBT, hashtag 90s girl, hashtag suns out, tongues out. These macabre visions, in direct opposition to the perfect pictures I'd see scrolling through my actual Instagram feed at my mom's bedside, of matcha lattes, pumpkin patches, and pizza pool floats, okay, I'm guilty of that last one, allowed me to speak out about what life with an addicted parent is like, even if I was only talking to myself. Though ultimately it was drugs that caused my mom's body to shut down, I wasn't raised by an addict. She's still vivacious in my memories. She was the infectiously charming single mom who had all my 14-year-old friends over for Sex in the City Sundays because their parents wouldn't let them tune in. Sorry, Mrs. Aronson. For years, I watched her make others feel beautiful one haircut at a time while I sat in the chair next to her every day after school listening to the sage advice she'd dole out to clients. When she couldn't take the body aches anymore, she went on disability and started living off the government, plus my paycheck. But hey, at least Medicaid covers painkillers. In the years leading up to her final overdose, I kept her entertained with all the streaming services money could provide, got her the most adorable puppy to replace me, and sent her seamless every time she blew her food stamps on Sour Patch Kids. But I was suffocating in shame that I couldn't provide a bigger life for her, even if she wasn't trying to do anything for herself. And how could she when opioids were numbing her senses, robbing her, an already lonely woman, of incentive? The pills gave her away without having to ask her daughter for cash to shave some hours off the clock. I'd give in to each text request, ignoring any promises I made to myself that I'd stop enabling her. I wouldn't yield to her whims until she demonstrated that she was making an effort to wean off the pills she was given every month, pills she needed. But if I said no, she'd give me an expert guilt trip about how she never denied me, or worse, she'd threaten to kill herself. A powerful trump card when she had the tools concealed in the vials she hoarded in boots in her bedroom closet. After all, she'd come so close before without even trying. I couldn't have it on my conscience, already so fat with self-reproach, that if only I had ordered her a hot dog, her death wouldn't be on my hands. Still, it was the dream editions of Instagram posts that kept my sense of humor kicking through the trying times she remained confined to her uncaring care facility, where she was sent to recoup after 3 months spent in a hospital bed caused her muscles to atrophy. I wonder if by strictly keeping this part of my existence to a pretend Instagram account in my head, I was betraying my peers who were also trying to present as normal while coping with the messy effects of loving an addict. Perhaps if I made these sardonic posts public, I could help someone who was suffering in silent shame. Together, through slumped over photos of our moms, we could show the toll addiction takes on families, because we're not the ones who are too drug numb to feel how much it hurts to cherish someone who's not mentally there. I wouldn't ask questions. I wouldn't tell them it gets better because it probably doesn't. I just assure them they're not to blame, that they did their best despite the gnawing voice telling them that their best will never be good enough. My mom died on Mother's Day 2019. I'd like to think it was her having the last laugh, one final reminder that I was her whole existence. The night before she passed, I watched her tearfully read the card I wrote. It explained that I understood her, that I forgave her, and that I'd find a way to forgive myself for never being able to fix her. For not having the courage to force her to go to rehab and for failing to convince her to find a doctor that would experiment with alternative ways to treat her crippling afflictions. She was groaning in discomfort from a stomach pain that her aides blamed on the Chinese food I smuggled in. It was getting late, and my husband and I were eager to head back to the city after a long day of watching her vomit lo mein into a bedpan, knowing there was nothing I could really do to bring her comfort. She asked us to stay a bit longer, but we had a train to catch, so I kissed her goodbye. A few hours later, I learned that they were sending her back to the hospital. The call came around 4 a.m. that she died en route. As I'm coming up on my third Mother's Day without her, it's getting slightly easier to stop thinking about the look she gave me, silently asking me to remain by her side. I am also filled with gratitude that her nursing home chapter ended before the coronavirus began, or else I would have shared the burden of so many others who couldn't be there to provide a glimmer of sunshine for their interned loved ones. though I do wish she was alive to see my husband's shoulder-length COVID curls. She always teased him for his boy band flip. Months after I hosted a tequila and balloon-filled, two of her favorite things, memorial celebration, I did ultimately share something mawkish but also authentic on Instagram. For a while, the post was holding steady at 143 likes, our shorthand for I love you. It felt like a sign my mom wanted our story told because she saw my grief, and as an empathetic armchair therapist, she knew that it was a sadness I had in common with so many others who have lost addicts and mourned not just for the person, but for the memories they could have made together if in sobriety hadn't robbed them of the chance. Or maybe she just liked the badass late 70s photo I chose of her in her pre-narcotic glory. Bo Derek cornrows before she knew what cultural appropriation was. Cutting shears in hand, and her signature swagger. Even though I wasn't yet born when that shot was snapped, it's one of the ways I choose to remember her, as a woman who'd go on to love her daughter more than anything, even though that intensity would never be a match for the paralyzing power of the pills hidden away in the seams of her purse. Our next article is titled, Oprah Says You Need to Know About This Pet Danger. On February 2nd, Jennifer Rudolph Walsh's husband brought their beloved French bulldog, Otis, to a new groomer in Montecito, California. Inside, the place was bustling with about 15 other pups milling around freely. Patrick Walsh asked if now was still a good time, even though he had an appointment, and the groomer assured him that everything was fine. The next time Jennifer and Patrick would see Otis was at the local animal hospital, where they retrieved his body. Otis had died within 2 hours of being dropped off to be groomed. While the circumstances that led to his death are hazy, it is clear why Otis died. He overheated. French bulldogs are a brachycephalic breed with a broad, short skull and flat face. Brachycephalic breeds have uniquely structured heads and can struggle to pant enough to cool off, according to the American Kennel Club. Their tendency to overheat requires owners to be extra vigilant on hot, humid days and groomers to take special care when drying them. The groomer where Otis was taken says he wasn't placed in a drying cage, a piece of equipment that hastens the drying process with heat. The Walshes are not so sure. In the end, the specifics don't matter much, says Jennifer. Their objective now is to help prevent harm occurring to other dogs at groomers, which require no license to operate. A fact most people don't realize. When fellow dog lover Oprah heard the news, she wanted to do whatever she could to raise awareness. As a devoted dog person, I'm on my 21st fur friend. I have great compassion and empathy for anyone who loses a dog unexpectedly. I've lost two that way, and it's particularly hard. Devastating, really. So naturally, I was heartbroken when my friend Jennifer told me Otis's story. I was so startled that I wanted to share it with all of you. Each of my own dogs taught me a lesson, some big, some small. When I asked Jennifer what she learned from raising Otis and this experience, she said, Otis was always able to bring people together. That was his joy. I always want reciprocity in my life, but I only really like the giving part. While telling people of the dangers of unregulated groomers and sometimes overwhelmed or neglectful groomers, I'm learning to not just give love, but to receive love and support on a profound level. That's how this has changed me. I wasn't aware of the extent of concerns common to bulldogs and French bulldogs. I did know that they had some trouble breathing, but I didn't realize they can easily overheat. I learned that even walking down the street on a mild day of 65 degrees, it's possible for them to not get enough air and die. That's very scary. These dogs are sensitive and require special care. Jennifer tells me that Otis was actually a healthy little guy. He had no anxieties, was outgoing, and even liked to sit in the sun. Of course, if she had known that there was the slightest chance he was in danger, she wouldn't have taken him to be groomed. I realized many years ago that the power of a soul is defined by the extent of its reach and impact. I now see little Otis had a big soul. We're still talking about him days after his passing. And I'm hoping that the messaging of his untimely death may save another fur friend's life. I know Jennifer and Patrick feel the same. Expert dog grooming advice. Of course, there are great groomers out there, but it's important to know that the experience might still be taxing for your dog. Here are some tips to help mitigate potential issues and help you protect your pet. Visit the groomer solo. The first thing I always tell my patients' owners is walk in without your dog before you go in for an appointment, says veterinarian Nancy Katz, owner of Cats and Dogs Animal Hospital in Montclair, New Jersey. When you go in with your dog, you're going to be more focused on your dog, which you should be, but there may be subtle things that you don't notice. Take a look around. If they won't let you, then that might be a sign to walk away. You want it to be an open environment, clean, and you want the groomer to be letting the dog take breaks, says Katz. Grooming requires a lot of standing, which can make some dogs anxious. Ask questions. Have your groomer take you through a step-by-step of what will be done to your dog and what's being used, suggests Katz. It's also a good idea to ask how many dogs will be there, she says, so you can consider factors like your pet's anxiety level, the potential for contagious diseases, and the duration of your dog's appointment. In addition, the American Kennel Club suggests asking things like, "Do you have experience with my dog's breed?" before scheduling an appointment with a new groomer. Communicate expectations. Make it clear to your groomer that you are comfortable with them stopping if they feel the dog is stressed in any way, says Katz. The groomer may feel a responsibility to get the job done, but discussing expectation puts you both on the same page. The dog's safety comes first, and it's okay if grooming needs to be done in stages every couple of weeks, perhaps. Consider at-home care. Regular brushing and combing at home can make a visit to the groomers easier, which means less agitation for your dog, suggests Katz. If you're going to go for a total DIY job, the American Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, or ASPCA, has guidance for safely grooming your pet at home, including instructions for bathing and toothbrushing, giving your dog an eye exam, and spotting problems that require a visit to the vet. And lastly, check for credentials. People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, or PETA, gives advice on how to help prevent accidents. First on the list is seeking out a groomer who is certified. While certification is not a requirement, having graduated from a training program or being a member of a trade organization like the National Dog Groomers Association often indicates professionalism, says PETA. Evidence of participation in industry seminars is also a good sign. We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and be sure to listen next time. I'm Brandi Spragata, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Oprah Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.